great pleasure to be here. Thank you to Masoud and the other organizers for the invitation. I'm going to talk about something that has been interesting me for years and years and years, and slowly I'm making some progress on it. I'm sure some of you, maybe all of you, have heard me talk about this before, so I apologize for the repetition. I'm going to talk about the Baum-Kahn conjecture, my favorite conjecture, and its connections to representation theory. So I'll be talking about Lie groups. It's rather well known that the Baum-Kahn conjecture, which I will explain in a moment, for Lie groups can be checked or verified using representation theory. If you have a particular Lie group, let's say a semi-simple Lie group, and you want to check that the conjecture is true, if you can calculate well enough the representation theory of that group, then you can verify the conjecture. Conjecture is not a conjecture anymore for Lie groups, it's a theorem, but we still call it a conjecture. What I want to talk about today is, to a certain extent, the reverse of that procedure. I should like to examine the Baum-Kahn conjecture and see what it might suggest about representation theory, what point of view, what new light it might possibly shed on representation theory. I think this is a rather interesting subject, because what emerges is a picture which is not the standard picture that the representation theorists have, as I'll explain in a moment. I should also say before I start that this is very much inspired, what I'm doing is very much inspired by the case of p-adic groups. Back, I don't know, 10 years ago or so, I was involved in the p-adic game a little bit. We checked the Baum-Kahn conjecture for GLN using representation theory. And Paul Baum and his collaborators have gone on and continue to work in this area. I felt that I didn't know anything about representation theory, so I should just stop. And what I've been doing in the meantime is going back to school and learning some much simpler representation theory, the representation theory of real and complex semi-simple Lie groups. But the ultimate goal is to connect with representation theory of p-adic groups. And in particular, what I'm going to talk about today is very closely related to what Paul Baum will talk about sometime later in the week, when he arrives here. All right. To get some inspiration, let me look at one case of the Baum-Kahn conjecture which is maximally well understood. So this inspirational case is not a Lie group at all, except in some sort of trivial sense. It's a pre-abelian group. So what the Baum-Kahn conjecture says is that over here, there is K-theory, the C-star algebra of G. Strictly speaking, it should be the reduced C-star algebra. And the conjecture is an answer to the question. And the question is, what is this? And the answer is that there's some other group which you build called K-top of G, and there's a certain map which is always called mu. And the conjecture is that mu is always an isomorphism. So that's what the conjecture says for any group. It's kind of interesting to see what this all boils down to in the case of Z to the N. On the one hand, if we look at the left-hand side, of course, Z to the N is an abelian group, so the C-star algebra is an abelian C-star algebra, and therefore it's continuous functions on some space, and Fourier theory tells you what the space is. It's just the dual of the group G, which is just some torus, T. Okay, so like Fourier allows you to identify the left, the right-hand side of the K-theory of a torus. On the other hand, what appears on the left-hand side, well, strictly speaking, what appears on the left-hand side is some K-homology group, but this you can calculate using Poincaré duality for the case of a torus, and what for a pre-abelian group, and what you get is the K-theory of a torus. It's not the same torus, it's the dual torus. And one has some map in between. And this map one can identify in terms of other previously studied things. This is a so-called Fourier-Mackay duality isomorphism. So in this particular case, the Baumkuhn conjecture assumes a very pleasing form, which suggests a number of things. First of all, it suggests that the Baumkuhn map really should be an isomorphism, because after all, once you've done this once, who could resist the temptation to do it again? Maybe I should say, do it again on this side, and go from the K-theory of the dual torus, to the K-theory of the dual torus, and then the K-theory of the torus itself. Of course, the dual of the dual is always the thing you first thought of. So this map here is effectively its own inverse, and that explains why the Baumkuhn map should be an isomorphism. So it's a very satisfactory situation. First of all, we see the Baumkuhn map as some sort of duality isomorphism. Second of all, this map is a theoretic map which can be, in the language currently fashionable, categorified. This map underlies a much more detailed correspondence between vector bundles on T hat and vector bundles on T, which I won't go into. So we have a very satisfactory situation in which the left-hand side and the right-hand side of the Baumkuhn map are practically the same thing, and the map between them is a highly non-trivial and highly interesting isomorphism. So we should like to see whether in the world of Lie groups something approaching this can be duplicated. Well, I don't have anywhere near as clear an understanding of what happens to Lie groups as we have here. Nonetheless, there are some very tantalizing clues. That's what I'd like to talk about. So for the most part, I'll talk about simple groups. Well, at the moment, the picture, as I say, is not completely clear. But let me draw a little picture to attempt to convey to you what I think the Baumkuhn isomorphism is contributing to representation theory. So up here, let me draw just some blob standing for representations of G. We have the world of representations of G. Now, in representation theory, one of the fundamental constructions is the so-called infinitesimal character, which we'll discuss in a little bit. And the parameter space for the infinitesimal character is a certain algebraic variety. It turns out just to be C to the N. Is some space over which the representations lie. If you have a representation of G subject to some hypotheses, it decomposes in a natural way over the space so that, for example, an irreducible representation sits over a single point in the space. And the picture is in some respects very nice. So over any given point of the parameter space, there are just finitely many representations. And the whole game in geometric representation theory is to understand what these fibers look like. It's a finite set, but it's fabulously complicated. Yeah? Affine algebraic variety. Yes. Yeah. It's an affine algebraic variety, but it's not actually interesting as a variety. It's just C to the N, or C to the N. Yeah. So we have a finite number of representations over this point, but there's a lot going on in this finite number of representations. If you attempt to study not the irreducible representations, but the category of all representations with a given infinitesimal character, it's a very, very interesting subject. This is the territory of Kajdan-Lustig conjectures, Baylis and Bernstein, and so on. So there's a lot going on in this direction in geometric representation theory. On the other hand, Baumkuhn theory, if you like, what the Baumkuhn conjecture seems to be more about is the structure, the longitudinal structure of this space, rather than the transverse structure of this space. So when one looks at the Baumkuhn conjecture and attempts to be informed by the conjecture about representation theory, what you get is something which is a little bit different from what the representation theorists study. And that makes it hard to talk to these guys because you're talking, you know, we're talking this way and the geometric representation theorists are talking this way. It's a very interesting conversation. But I mean, it suggests that there's something in our world, non-commutative geometry, which we could usefully contribute to the world of representations, these guys going up and down while we're going left and right. Okay. So this is a picture to keep in mind. We'll come back to these little dots in a little while. Now, let me formulate this conjecture precisely for Lie groups so we have something a little more concrete to talk about. So suppose G is a connected, I mean, the world of discrete groups is very, very interesting, but let me opposite extreme here, the world of connected Lie groups. There is attached to this connected Lie group a canonical one-parameter family of Lie groups once you've chosen a maximal compact subgroup. Canonical groupoid, if you like, over R, or over C even, over R. This is some groups, which I'll explain what it is. In order to explain what it is, let me just consider a simple case, which is the case that we'll be most occupied with anyway. So suppose G is a semi-simple Lie group, in which case it has so-called time decomposition. Think of this, if you're not familiar with semi-simple groups. Think of SLN R, think of the skew symmetric matrices and the symmetric matrices. Every matrix is a combination of a skew symmetric and a symmetric matrix. Okay, and the feature of this decomposition, first of all, is that it's K invariant, and second of all, among other things, the bracket of two elements of P is some element of K. Okay, in this situation, let's look up a little bit, we can deform the Lie bracket on G in the following way. Define a new bracket just by multiplying the old bracket by T squared, if X and Y happen to belong to T, and just doing nothing otherwise. Of course, and extend by linearity. So this is a one-parameter family of Lie algebras, and this you can exponentiate to obtain a one-parameter family of Lie groups. So what's going on here by rescaling is that GT is just a copy of G if T is not zero. On the other hand, G0 is a quite a different object entirely. It's just a semi-direct product group, K acting on P, or in general, the quotient of the Lie algebra of G and the Lie algebra of K. So we can form for each value of T the reduced Feaster algebra of G, like this. And for that matter, the K theory. And what we obtain is some family at the bottom there, some family of abelian groups over the real line, some pre-sheaf, and the Baum-Conn conjecture is a family of a particularly nice sort. All of the fibers of this family of Feaster algebras, or this family of abelian groups, all of the fibers away from T is equal to zero are all the same as one another by virtue of this fact here. So this is another way of pitching an asymptotic morphism, if you like. And what Conn and I indicated a long time ago, 20 years or so ago, is that the Baum-Conn conjecture is exactly the same as saying that this field of Feaster algebras has constant K theory. All right, so it's that's what the conjecture says. Let's look at maybe very quickly, I don't want to dwell on this, on a simple example. This is an example which is not at all representative of what I want to talk about. about, but it indicates there's something interesting going on. Suppose we take the Heisenberg group. So this group has no maximal compact subgroup, and that means that when you perform this deformation, what you're actually doing is shrinking the Lie bracket to zero. And you're just getting an abelian algebra here. And now it's interesting to look at what happens at the level of representations. See if we can draw a little picture here. Here's a picture of the dual of H, the unitary dual of H. This element Z up here spans the center of G. In any irreducible representation, of course, the center must act as scalars. So we have a one-parameter group acting as scalars. It's given by some fixed real number. So in this vertical direction, we have a parameterization, which is, if you like, the central charge. And according to the theorem of von Neumann and Weyl, for a non-zero central charge, there's a unique irreducible representation. On the other hand, at zero, the center is acting trivially, so what we have is effectively a representation of the quotient of H by its center, which is just R2. We get a whole plane's worth of representations. Of course, the dual of R3 is just R3. So these are what the unitary representations look like, and you see that what's happening is that an entire plane's worth of representations of R3 is getting crunched down to a single point here, and it's not really surprising that the isomorphism here predicted by the Baumkorn conjecture is some manifestation of Bott periodicity. Okay. Okay. This is not what I want to talk about. I want to talk about the other extreme of the world of Lie groups, semi-simple groups, and there something rather surprising happens, which was first predicted by Mackey. So Mackey, of course, was a great expert in studying the representation theory of groups like G0, semi-direct products. He developed an entire apparatus. Yeah, in the case of a Heisenberg group, K is equal to zero. So the Heisenberg group is a degenerate example of this phenomenon in which P is everything, G is equal to P. So what Mackey proposed in the early 1970s. He wrote a very interesting paper which he didn't follow up on. In fact, nobody followed up on at all for a long time. But what he wrote is that if the group is semi-simple, for example, SLNR, in terms of irreducible representations, unitary representations, what he said is that these really ought to be the same. Well, he was a measure theorist at heart, so the same almost everywhere. So a statement like this is certainly consistent with this reformulation of the Baum-Kahn conjecture, which is saying that at least at the level of K-theory, G and G0 ought to be the same. So let me just indicate quickly why it is that Mackey thought this ought to be so, or proposed this ought to be so. As I say, there's an elaborate machine due to Mackey designed to calculate the representation theory of semi-direct products like this. We're dealing with a very, very simple situation here, which is basically easily handleable just by Fourier theory alone. Here's what you do. You start off with a character of P. And then you look at that part of the compact subgroup K, which fixes that character, which of course is acting on P and therefore on P star. And you look at all of the irreducible representations of that isotropy group. If you have phi and an irreducible representation of k phi, you can tensor them together, get an irreducible representation of the semi-direct product of k phi acting on p, and then you can induce that to g, and Mackie shows that all such representations are irreducible. That's all the irreducible representations you get, and the only coincidences among those representations come by conjugacy through k, like that. So there's a simple formula, simple in some sense, formula for G0 hat. All right. So let's suppose that, and this is really the case I'll concentrate on in this lecture, because it's the easiest and it's the only one I even partially understand. So let's use complex semi-simple. Let me describe the main family of representations of G. So first of all, there's a standard lexicon of subgroups of G which is dealt with in semi-simple theory. At the level of the algebras, there's a K. Inside P, one chooses a maximal abelian subgroup, subspace, which is called A. And then there's an N, which I won't describe. In the case of SLNR, N is the unipotent, or rather nilpotent upper triangular matrices. A is the diagonal matrices. Need just a little bit more notation. M always stands for the centralizer in K of A, and the vowel group W stands for the normalizer in K of A divided by the centralizer.
I'm just following up on the code question about the special case. If K is zero, I mean, do you really mean that P commutator with P is? Do you just mean that P is commutator with P is contained in P?
Yeah. What I said, I guess I didn't write it down, but if G is semi-simple, it possesses a so-called Cartan decomposition for which this holds.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Of course, that doesn't hold in this case.
You have a different situation.
Yeah. In the case of a semi-simple group, you can really write down this deformation in a completely concrete way. So just a little less concrete in the case of a non-semi-simple group. Well, he wasn't particularly precise about what almost everywhere meant. We'll come back to that in a moment, and we'll see that almost everywhere actually means everywhere. Okay, so here are the representations of G0. What about the representations of G? Well, they come in various sorts, but the most important family of representations are the so-called principal series, and they're parametrized as follows. First of all, let's build this group B, if you like, of upper triangular matrices. The diagonal matrices are a natural quotient of B, and we can obtain a representation of G by taking a character of this group B, which is, in other words, just a character of M times a character of A, inducing up to G. So the parameter space for those representations would be M cross A star, and it turns out that there are equivalences among those representations coming from this permutation action of the vowel group W. Now what Mackie observed going back to G0, what Mackie observed is that typically the only elements of K which stabilize a typical, a generic phi, are those elements which lie in M. This or this up to conjugacy, of course, we're dividing out by k here. So the physical elements of G0 hat are parameterized in exactly the same way. Okay. This is the sort of Mackie had in mind when he was talking about almost everywhere. There are some characters phi for which the isotropy group is much bigger. For example, if phi is a trivial character, then the isotropy group, of course, is all of k. But typically, what happens is phi is generic enough that it's the only elements of k which stabilize it are those which are diagonal matrices. Okay. Now, Mackie was much more interested in actual representation spaces than parameters, and so he was keen to observe not only is there a correspondence between representation of parameter spaces, but in fact the representations themselves are in some sense very closely analogous, but I won't go into that here because that seems to be really consistent with the Baum-Kahn ideology. And then he kind of left the subject. He never wrote another paper about this, and the subject was left a little bit hanging. In particular, there was no clear explanation of what typical ought to mean in general, or even in this particular case. But let me show you that if you look at this a little bit more carefully, something rather interesting happens. So let's let's notice two things. First of all, it was proved about the time that Mackie was thinking about this issue that all of the representations in the unitary principle series are irreducible representations. That's not a point which I mentioned over there. And in fact, the irreducible the principle series constitute exactly the so-called tempered dual, the reduced dual of G. And now back to this thing here, G0. See if we can fit this calculation just in this line here. Let's attempt to calculate this space. So this is a certain space which fibers over P star divided by K. But P star divided by K is the same thing as A star divided by W. All symmetric matrices up to conjugacy is the same thing as all diagonal matrices up to permutation. Not going to quite fit it in. Down here. That must have hurt someone's ears listening to this. And screwed up my shirt as well. So continuing this calculation a little bit. Now, what is the dual of k phi hat? Well, according to the Cartan-Weil theory, the first weight, you can list all the representations of a connected compact group. Groups all turn out to be connected in the complex semisimple case, which is one of the reasons it's so amenable to analysis. You can list all the representations by understanding their highest weights, which is to say you can list all the representations by labeling them by a character of the maximal torus. Now, the maximal torus of k-phi is always m. According to Cartan and Weil, you're supposed to only analyze representations up to attached to irreducible representations, characters up to conjugacy by the Weil group. And the Weil group of k-phi we'll call w-phi. So we get this picture here. And now if you think about this for a moment, this is exactly the same thing as m hat cross a star over w, which is exactly g hat. So if Mackie had gone a little bit further, he would have noticed that not only is there a correspondence almost everywhere between G hat and G zero hat, but if you're willing to consider only the tempered dual, in fact the correspondence is a bijection. It means everywhere. If you deal with the tempered dual, reduced dual, as opposed to a unitary dual. Right, G has a trivial representation, and the trivial representation does not correspond to anything which is a unitary representation of G0. It does, I'll show you, correspond to some representation of G0, but not a unitary representation. Okay. So it's kind of an interesting situation here. We now have this Mackey analogy, which we can, in fact, call a Mackey bijection. We have the Baumkorn isomorphism. They're not entirely consistent with one another, or they're not. One does not entirely explain the other. The reason is that this identification of spaces. Well, one indication that they're not entirely consistent is that this identification of space is not a homeomorphism. But there is one statement which simultaneously accounts for both of these isomorphisms together, and it goes like this. Suppose I take irreducible representation of K, let's call it pi, then let's denote by this thing here the representation of a G with lowest K type pi. In other words, so you take an irreducible representation of G, you restrict it to the maximal compact subgroup K, and you look at all of the irreducible representations of K which occur. They're ordered by this Cartan-Weyl theory of highest weights, and among if you refine that partial order on highest weights to a linear order, then there will have to be a lowest one, and we'll gather together all of the representations with a given lowest weight, and we'll call that G hat of pi. So this is some locally closed subset. It corresponds to a subquotient of the Cster algebra. And now there are two facts that you can calculate using representation theory. The first is that if, I don't know, sigma is in G hat of pi, then the multiplicity with which pi occurs in sigma is always 1. The second is that if we go back to this continuous field of, smooth field of Lie groups that we started out with, these G sub t's, and we look at the one parameter family of spaces associated to a given pi, this here is a trivial field of locally compact spaces over the parameter space. Ah. These are calculations which you can carry out in representation theory. At the level of Cster algebras, what this is saying is that the continuous field of Cster algebras, which gives rise to the Baumkorn isomorphism, is assembled from constant fields via extensions and Morita equivalences. So in particular, it has constant K theory. Of course, if this is a trivial field, then we get the bijection, which is also in on this board right here. Okay. So this is a kind of an encouraging state of affairs. There's some much more refined statement than the Baumkorn conjecture, which simultaneously tidies up Mackey's isomorphism and implies, or tidies up, makes more detailed the Baumkorn isomorphism. And it's this that I'd like to study in a bit more detail in the remainder of the lecture. One of the reasons I'm going to talk about complex semi-simple groups for which everything we need to know is already known. But one of the reasons I should like to understand what is going on here much better is that, first of all, these are not completely trivial calculations. I mean, I'm borrowing from Harishchandra's Pascherelle theorem, basically, plus additional ideas in order to write down these formulas. Secondly, when you pass from complex semisimple groups to real semisimple groups, the corresponding calculations turn out to be fantastically difficult. And the reason they turn out to be fantastically difficult is that these groups, K phi, are no longer connected, and therefore their representation theory is not given by Cartan-Weyl theory. It's given in a much more complicated way. So in order to understand what's going on here better, I want to study this situation in more detail. And for reasons that I can't go into in very much here, it's appropriate to do so not in the context of tempered representations, but in the context of what are called admissible representations. So let's ask ourselves whether the bijection that we've just been studying here still exists for admissible representations. There's a classification theorem of Langlands which says that to understand the admissible representations, it really suffices to understand the tempered representations. The space of all admissible representations is obtained by adding some continuous parameters to the space of tempered representations. That's a difficult theorem which relies on the analysis of matrix coefficients, which is behind a lot of what's going on here, the Pascherelle formula and so on. To get rid of the analysis and try and understand the algebraic essence of the matter, I want to study these things here, which are built out of what are called GK modules. So a GK module is simultaneously a representation of the Lie algebra G on some vector space V and a representation of K, which is, well, the technical condition, locally finite. And of course, the two things should be compatible in every way that you could imagine they might be. So these were invented by Harishchandra back in the early days, back in the 1950s, which was the last time that C-star algebraists were really into representation theory and contributing to the representation theory of Lie groups, very simple Lie groups. Okay. So the admissible dual is the set of irreducible such GK modules up to equivalence. And there's an algebra in the algebraic world which plays the role of the C-star algebra or the reduced C-star algebra that we're familiar with. And it's called the Hecker algebra. And it's a slightly complicated thing. You take the enveloping algebra of G, or the complexification of G, then you take the algebra of class functions on K, representative functions on K. That's the tensor product of two algebras. So far, so good. But then you do something kind of crazy. You take a tensor product over the enveloping algebra of K, which acts on C of K in the obvious way on the left. So it's kind of a complicated thing. It's not obvious it's even an algebra. I won't go into this because I want to consider a much smaller and somewhat more comprehensible object. So let me change notation a little bit. Over here I was describing irreducible representations of K by little pi's. Let me use E now instead. This is some irreducible representation space. Okay. Let me denote by A of E a sort of local version of this Hecker algebra. And here's what it is. Well, it may look not much better to you, but we'll see that this is a fairly decent object to study. A few minutes I have left. Now, what does this local thing do? A module over this Hecker algebra, I forgot to say it, but a module over this Hecker algebra is the same thing as a GK module, because a module over this Hecker algebra gives a representation of G, and it gives a representation of K, and there's some compatibility between them. And each time you have a module over the Hecker algebra, you can get a module over this local guy, A of E, in the following way. You just send V to the intertwiners from E into V, like this. Okay, I forgot to tell you how this thing is an algebra, so maybe I'll write it down here. So if I have two elements of this fellow, I don't know, an X tensor and S, and a Y tensor and T, the product is by definition XY tensor TS. There's a reversal here which is consistent with what's going on over here. Clearly, this is an A, how do we make this into an A of E module? Well, of course, U of G acts on V, and endomorphisms of E act on E. So it may happen that the K-type E does not appear in V, in which case this is zero. But that's the worst that can happen. This map, this functor here, has both left and right adjoints. And it induces an isomorphism on irreducibles. As long as over here we deal with irreducible representations which contain the K-type E. Which this multiplicity here is at least non-zero. So if we want to understand representations of G, we could understand one irreducible representation of K at a time, representations of this algebra A of E here. And there's a reason for doing that, because A of E is a real, from the point of view of a C-star algebra, it's a real tame thing. Of course, it's not a C-star algebra, so that's the whole problem. So here's A of E again, this thing here. If I take the center of the enveloping algebra of G, of course the center tends to the identity, consists of K invariant elements. So the center of the enveloping algebra of G maps into the center of this algebra. And this thing here turns out to be a so-called finite type algebra. Over the center of G. In other words, it's finitely generated as a module over this algebra. So in the world of C-star algebras, the analog would be a C-star algebra with only finite dimensional representations, irreducible representations. Okay. All right. Now, in order to analyze this a little further, let me go back to the case of complex semi-simple groups again. There's an interesting and useful simplification which occurs if you deal with complex semi-simple groups, and I should say that I see Eckhart is in the room, maybe I'll ask him afterwards. I don't understand what to do in the non-complex semi-simple case. But in the complex semi-simple case, if you complexify the Lie algebra, you just get two copies, this is well known, of the Lie algebra of K. There's a splitting. And as a result of this, this rather complicated tensor product over U of K becomes a much simpler object. Just a tensor product over the complex numbers, like this. So these algebras were studied by Kirillov, sort of on speculation that they might be interesting for representation theory, and indeed they are. These are what Kirillov calls family algebras. Mind if I spend five more minutes than I was allotted? Okay.
So you started 5 minutes later.
Okay, thank you. Very grateful. All right. So, the story so far is that if we understand the representations of this algebra, this is a finite type algebra, all of its representations, its irreducible representations, are finite dimensional. If we understand the finite dimensional representations of this algebra, we will understand the irreducible representations of the group G. Now, what are these algebras? Well, the simplest one to consider is the example where E is just a trivial representation. Actually, I wanted to do something before that, but anyway. So if E is a complex number, you can forget about this term here. We're just looking at the K-invariant part of the enveloping algebra. In other words, we're looking at the center of the enveloping algebra of K. Now, here's what I wanted to mention before I said this. This algebra, A of E, is always a filtered algebra. It obtains a filtration just from the filtration of the enveloping algebra. And the associated graded algebra converts the enveloping algebra just into the symmetric algebra. And the reason that I write this down is that this is exactly what you would get if you started the entire enterprise from this board up here all the way down to over here, not with the group G, but with the group G0, which would lead you to a local Hecker algebra A0. So Mackey's G0 provides a sort of first-order approximation to G and the level of algebra, so this is what it's saying. But Mackey says that not only is A0 a first-order approximation to this, in a certain sense, it's an exact approximation. That's what Mackey is saying. And let's just see what that amounts to. So going back to this trivial guy, the A0 algebra, of course, is just the invariant part of the symmetric algebra, and A is just the center. And these are well known to be one and the same algebra via the Harris-Chandra isomorphism. So an explicit isomorphism, which I don't have time to describe in detail, which links these algebras. So they are one and the same algebra, just like Mackey said they ought to be. In fact, you can say a little bit more. There's a non-trivial symmetrization isomorphism between the symmetric algebra as a vector space and the enveloping algebra as a vector space. Which is an isomorphism not of algebras, it couldn't be, after all this thing here is non-abelian and this is abelian, but it's an isomorphism of modules over Z of K. Or if you like this guy here. Harris-Chandra's original approach to the to his isomorphism, the thing at the top board there, was highly representation theoretic, very analytic in fact, involved a great deal of analysis of, if you like, intertwining operators between representations. Subsequently, just in the last decade or so, new proofs have been found which are very beautiful, very geometric. The one which I think is most relevant to what I'm talking about is due to Alexeyev and Minorenkin, It's stimulated by the observation that this algebra which appears on the left-hand side is the central character in Chernevay theory in equivariant cohomology. And Alexeyev and Meinrankin found a beautiful proof of this in the language of equivariant cohomology, non-commutative, if you like, equivariant cohomology. Anyway, because of this additional feature, we can do the following thing. Suppose I have a character, an infinitesimal character, if you like, a homomorphism from Z of K to C. I can form a quotient of A of E, which is tailored to those representations, those irreducible representations, which, when restricted to the center of the enveloping algebra of K, act as this character phi. Now let me reintroduce the parameter t, which disappeared for a while. And do this for each t in the family of Lie groups G sub t. What I get is a family of finite dimensional algebras and this is a family of finite dimensional algebras on the same underlying vector space. Making these identifications that I've discussed up here. Now if you have a one parameter family, if you're a C-star algebraist and you have a one parameter family of finite dimensional algebras, I mean they're all the same, and you're done, right? You've identified the representation theory of G with the representation theory of G0. That doesn't quite work here, but we certainly get a map from the K-theory of A0 to the K-theory, let's say, of A1. And one of the things you can say about finite dimensional algebras in general, even outside of the world of C-star algebras, is that the K-theory, built out of projective modules of the finite dimensional algebra, is the same thing as the free abelian group generated by the irreducible, the simple modules. So by a little bit of finite dimensional algebra, this K-theory group is the same thing as the Grothendieck group of generated by the simple modules. Same thing over here. So the end of the story is this, that by means of this analysis, using the Chandra isomorphism, this slight refinement, which is clear, for example, from the work of Alexeyev and Meinrankin, is that we get now a definite map implementing Mackey's analogy. I have an irreducible representation of G0. It gives me, for some phi, an element in this group here, and it's mapped over here to, well, not necessarily an irreducible representation, but a linear combination, a formal virtual representation, okay? And the theorem is, of course, that it actually is a bijection, as indicated in the C-star algebra case before. All right, so what I've attempted to show you is that there is a hope of understanding, with just a modest amount of ideas from non-commutative geometry, from E-theory, if you like, there's a hope of understanding this Mackey correspondence in a very explicit way, and maybe obtaining a new look at representation theory of semi-simple groups as a consequence. I've got to stop. Thank you. Okay.